from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tomorrow in Washington, the White House launches a two-day summit on the national economy. White House-friendly academics, corporate chieftains, and economists will gather to hold forth on issues from Social Security to health care. And reforming the U.S. tax code ranks high on the agenda. Proposals include sacking the income tax for a broad-based consumption tax or implementing even a flat tax, a real shakeup. Tonight on Point, a look ahead at President Bush's big push for tax reform and what it may mean for the country and for you. We begin tonight in Washington with a preview of President Bush's economic conference. Jim McTague is Washington editor of Barron's and joins me now. Jim, thanks for being with us tonight.
Glad to be here.
So some people having fun with this. David Brooks today calling this a punditus maximus, a gathering of what we call it, the wonks lawyer jirga. But in all seriousness, what's going on with this national conference on the economy that the president is putting up? What's he hoping to learn or to accomplish with the conference?
Well, think Gilbert and Sullivan. This is the overture. He's teeing up his agenda, which is a very ambitious agenda. And he's also paying back some supporters with a pretty nice junket and some quality time.
That is some very high-profile advisory status for the president.
Yes, but he's trying to get some TV time. He wants the American public to be aware of what he intends to accomplish in the next year. And this is Act One. He did a similar thing back when he was first elected. He had a meeting in July of 2001 in Austin, Texas, with business leaders. And at that time, he held it. It was a clandestine meeting. I mean, no press was allowed into this thing. And that caused some problems for him because he had been criticizing Hillary during the campaign for her secret health care meetings.
Right. This time he's in Washington in the Ronald Reagan building, just blocks from the White House. He'll be there himself. Vice President Cheney will be there. Everyone talks about how ambitious his agenda for this second term is. Explain that to us, Jim. What's at the top of that ambitious lineup?
Well, Social Security has to be at the top. And, it wouldn't have mattered if Kerry was elected. This president has to address Social Security. It will melt down at some point, and it's better to fix it sooner than later. And so he has a wonderful opportunity to fix it because he has a majority in of Republicans in both the House and the Senate. And I think that the Democrats realize that for the good of the country, some reform measure has to be taken.
So hugely consequential there. He also wants to go after litigation and the kinds of settlements around malpractice and other in the courts, and also tax reform.
Yes. Now, tax reform, I don't think you're going to see a flat tax or any major overhaul. It's just too complicated, and there are too many special interests. So I believe they'll tweak the existing system and make it more friendly towards savings and investment, and that'll be about the best they can accomplish.
But the president has talked big about it, and despite all those interests, he's got a lot of people behind him who would like to see some real movement on this.
Yeah, I'm skeptical. We've tried tax reform in Washington before. The transition period, say, from a flat tax, from our current tax, would be a minimum of 10 years to give court, that just won't work. We had tax reform in 1986 under Reagan, and within 3 years, the Congress had pulled it to pieces.
Jim McTague, on the economic front, President Bush has got John Snow back as Treasury Secretary after the kind of public wobble on Mr. Snow. His senior White House economic advisor, Stephen Friedman, no replacement named yet. Greg Mankiw expected to leave soon, and no replacement there. What's with the empty deck chairs on that front?
I don't know. They've had so much turnover on the economic team. Remember, Larry Lindsey was the architect of his tax and economic plan, and Larry spoke a truth in public. He correctly estimated the cost of the war in Iraq, and they booted him out. Then we had Paul O'Neill booted out. He was kind of a loose cannon. They've had lots of turnover on that economic team. I sometimes wonder how in the last administration, how focused the president himself was on the details. I think he left it up to his team, but several members left in frustration because the Republicans on the Hill we're spending like Democrats used to. Mm.
But you describe what's coming up tomorrow as Gilbert and Sullivan, the curtain goes up. That is, the president kind of giving the public a big eyeful and earful of his agenda, warming up Washington and the country for his effort to push some of these through.
He wants his people on the boob tube. He wants that message out. He wants it on the big three networks and the Daily Show. So he wants everybody to know that Social Security and tax reform are on the way.
Here they come. Jim McTague, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Jim McTague, Washington editor of Barron's, spoke with me from Washington. So President Bush has promised to simplify federal taxes. He's not known for taking baby steps. He's already implemented big tax cuts. Reform toward a consumption tax or flat tax could dramatically change who pays the government's bills and who doesn't. Yes, there are a lot of interest there, but yes, there's a push as well. This hour, On Point, President Bush's call for tax reform and what it could mean for the country and for you. What about it? Are you chomping at the bit for tax reform? Are you rooting for a flat tax, a consumption tax, for no tax? Are you confident that whatever tax reform comes through will be fair? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight from San Francisco is William Gale, Deputy Director and Senior Fellow in Economic Studies at the Brookings Institution. He's co-director of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center and has written extensively on taxes and testified before Congress on tax policy. William Gale, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Milford, Connecticut, is Michael Gratz, professor of law at Yale University. His forthcoming book is Death by a Thousand Cuts, The Fight Over Taxing Inherited Wealth. He's also author of The Decline and Fall of the Income Tax. Michael Gratz, thank you for being with us tonight.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
So, William Gale, begin to lead us into this. You just heard from our correspondent in Washington that there's some skepticism about how far this president can get with tax reform. Yet President Bush talks big, and you know there are big ideas floating around out there. What are the big parameters? What kinds of changes are being considered for the way the federal government taxes U.S. citizens?
That can be answered on a couple levels. The quick, most direct answer is that they're looking for changes that will reduce the taxation of capital income, of saving and investment. And there, as a result, will make the system more regressive. And their hope is that it will boost economic growth sufficiently to make up for that. The problem is they're not talking about doing it in a systematic way. And what they're probably going to do is create new shelters rather than a well-designed tax system. The other thing people should think about as we start getting in a froth about tax reform is that the main tax issue facing the country right now is not actually reforming the system. It's whether we make the president's tax cuts permanent.
Mm-hmm.
Doing so would cost about five times as much as it would cost to fix Social Security over the next 75 years. So it's sort of making the tax cuts permanent is sort of the 800-pound gorilla sitting in a room that no one's talking about. And if I were the president wanting to make my tax cuts permanent and facing the budget deficits that we have, I would try to change the subject to tax reform, too.
Michael Gratz, you've got some proposals of your own on tax reform, but I wish you'd take us in first to whether Republican or Democrat, there's been agreement for a long time the country might be better off with some tax reform, many different ways of thinking about that. Why the interest in tax reform? What's the problem that tax reform would hypothetically address?
Well, you know, I'm more optimistic than Bill is that we might get some serious tax reform, and we certainly need it. The income tax is broken. It's broken for many reasons. Congress, Republicans and Democrats alike, use the tax code the way my mother used chicken soup, which is to cure any ill that society has, whether we need health insurance or education savings or whatever. It all comes through the tax code. And this creates enormous complexity for everyone, middle-income people as well as higher-income people. And the complexity and the wasteful costs that we're spending in complying with the tax system are producing a nation which no longer believes that one ought to file the taxes one owes or pay the taxes one owes. If you look at polling data, people's attitudes toward the tax system are such that they believe it's fine not to comply with the current income tax. The younger people believe this in many greater numbers than older people, so the problem will just increase down the road. And I think the tax system could be fairer to savings, or better, more favorable to savings than it is now, without the kind of regressive change that Bill suggests is necessarily coming from the administration.
Now, it's the word regressive usually comes up when we begin to talk about a flat tax or a move away from progressive income tax. There are thousands of nuances here, and you guys know most of them. But Michael Gretz, begin to walk us in here. Why do some who would change the tax code look toward the flat tax or a move away from progressive income tax, a move toward consumption tax? Give us some of the basics here. I'm sure that there's lots of provisos, but lay out the basics for us.
Well, if you go to a flat rate tax on consumption, or if you go to a national sales tax, as a group that calls itself the Fair Tax people are suggesting, it's odd because it's not a fair tax, it's an unfair tax, but somehow they've called themselves the Fair Tax folks. What you're doing is you really are attacking the basic premise that we ought to have taxes levied in a progressive way in accordance with ability to pay. And instead, their premise is that everyone ought to pay the same taxes as a percentage of either consumption or income, regardless of how wealthy they are.
What's the argument for that? We're so accustomed to the progressive income tax.
You know, the argument for it, which frankly I don't buy, and here I think Bill and I would agree, is that the economy will grow in such a massive way if we simply get rid of the income tax and substitute a national sales tax in its entirety for it, that everyone will somehow be better off. But in fact, it will really shift the burden of taxes away from the highest income people down toward the middle income people or upper middle income people, and we don't need to do that.
That's if you go to a consumption tax, which would essentially feel like a national sales tax for everybody.
Well, one of the proposals is a national sales tax. One of the flat tax proposal is in fact a kind of tax on consumption. It only taxes wages of individuals and exempts all income from savings or wealth, including dividends and interest and capital gains, from tax at the individual level, and has much the same effects. Each of these proposals have mechanisms to protect the people at the very bottom of the income scale, but they both shift the tax burden down from the highest income people.
William Gale, if I could, you've written that in some degree this administration has already moved in a kind of stealth way toward unannounced tax reform.
That's right. I don't think that's very controversial, actually. The what the president has done in the last 4 years has flattened rates, lowered them, and increased the tax exemptions for capital income, like the dividend tax cut, the expansion of 401ks and IRAs and in 2001 and so on. And that, if you think, those are basically moves toward a consumption tax. The way to think about this is consumption is the difference between what your income is and what you save out of your income.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you start out with a tax on all income and then you exempt all saving, what you're left with is a consumption tax. And so the president, the big moves in tax policy the last couple of years have all been consistent with a consumption tax with a flatter rate structure than we had in 2001.
Not announced, but drifting in that direction already, and maybe more to come. William Gale with the Brookings Institution and Michael Gretz at Yale Law School. Glad to have you with us tonight. Much more we want to learn here. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about President Bush's call for tax reform, the options on the table, and what they would mean for the country, maybe for you. Who do you think is likely to win and who to lose in a Bush tax reform? Will the rich get richer? Will the poor get the usual? Will the middle class get soaked? Or do we have a real opportunity for a fresh, fair start on taxes? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about President Bush's call for tax reform. You're going to be hearing more about it this week at the National Conference on the Economy the White House is putting on in Washington. Social Security is first in line, but behind that, tax reform. And over the next year, it is almost certain to be very much in the news. We want to understand better what it might mean. My guest tonight, William Gale, is with the Brookings Institution. He joins us tonight from San Francisco. And Michael Gratz, professor of law at Yale University, joining us tonight from Connecticut. You can join us as well at 1-800-423-8255. Are you chomping at the bit for tax reform? Are you confident that tax reform will be fair? And what about that consumption tax, a kind of national sales tax? Would that be fair? Would it make you save more? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Michael Gratz, I wish you'd share with us a proposal that you've got out on the table. I don't know if it's considered a serious contender or a kind of talking point, but it gives us a concrete example of one path toward tax reform, one that you're recommending. Could you walk us through it, just to give a sense of how someone from your with your bent imagines a tax reform that you'd vote for?
Sure, Tom, I'd love to. And I think it is being taken seriously in some quarters. Hopefully the president himself will take it seriously, but I haven't heard that from him.
Okay.
But we'll see. The proposal actually has four pieces. The first is to eliminate from filing the income tax 100 million tax returns, 150 million people. And you would do that by increasing the tax exemption for the income tax to $100,000.
So any household with $100,000 or below would not even file income tax returns?
Pay no income tax.
Okay.
People above that would pay an income tax at a rate of 25%.
A flat rate?
A flat rate, and they would then still be allowed to deduct their mortgage interest deductions and their charitable deductions.
Okay.
The corporate tax rate I would also lower to 25%. But I would at the same time, I would require corporations to report for taxes amounts much closer to what they report as income to their shareholders. And I think this is necessary in order to eliminate corporate tax shelters.
Mm-hmm. But for individuals, that $100,000 exemption would mean that instead of, I don't know, $125 million or $150 million, just 25 million Americans would pay income taxes, but they wouldn't stop paying taxes. How would that work?
They wouldn't stop paying taxes. The revenues that that are lost from increasing the tax exemption on the income tax, I would make up for by enacting a value-added tax, which is a form of sales tax,
mm-hmm.
a form of sales tax that's actually much more collectible. It's used in 120 countries throughout the world. We're really the only large country in the world that doesn't have a value-added tax.
And what kind of percentage would that be?
Well, it'll take a percentage of about 14% in order to do the things that that I think you need to do.
And on everything, whether it's potatoes or a yacht?
It's 14% on potatoes and a yacht, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that shifts it toward a lot of taxation toward this consumption.
It does. Now, the other piece, let me just mention last piece because it's important,
mm-hmm.
which is that I would allow refunds of people's payroll taxes at low and middle incomes to offset any tax increases from the value-added tax and to retain the earned income tax credit.
So okay, now that's important because
it is important.
Because William Gay will remind us in a moment, as he has already, consumption taxes are regressive because if you have less income, you're going to be spending a greater portion of it on that tax. But you're saying you would, and also there's a kind of a, I don't have the language here, but the poor get a tax sort of, help me out here.
They essentially get a refund of what they would otherwise be paying in payroll taxes.
Right. So you'd say give them a break on their payroll taxes, including towards Social Security, to offset
that. It won't affect the Social Security Trust Fund.
But it would be what might otherwise have gone to Social Security from
that otherwise would be deposited by their employers.
And you would cut that to reduce the impact of the regressive effect. Now, we'll get William Gale's response in just a moment, but why do you propose this? What would the advantage of this system be? That is, 100,000 plus only paying income tax, everybody above that paying 25%, everybody paying a consumption tax and some kind of special considerations for the poor. What's the advantage in this,
McGrath? Well, it has about five advantages. Let me do them quickly. One is it removes 100 million returns, and so for 150 million people, April 15th is just another day and not tax day. Secondly, it is much more favorable to savings and economic growth because for most people, there would be no tax on savings and everyone would have a lower tax rate on savings. It would be better for compliance. A person who avoids income taxes either by taking cash or operating in the legal economy would pay taxes when they buy goods and services. So you would pick up a lot of the money you're losing now from tax cheaters. It eliminates all marriage penalties in the tax system. It reduces the IRS workload so the IRS can actually do its job. One of the big problems with tax shelters these days is that the IRS can't enforce the current
tax.
Can't keep up with it. And then finally, it does not shift the income tax burden down the income scale, so it's fair. The people at the high end would pay both the income tax and the consumption tax. And this may seem really radical to you, Tom, but in fact, this is pretty much the same kind of system the U.S. had from the beginning of the income tax through the beginning of the Second World War, when we had taxes on consumption for most people. It was just a bad consumption tax. It was tariffs. And income tax limited to a top slice of the American people.
So in a sense, we've been there before. William Gale, wade in here. We clearly don't know if what comes out of Washington will be anything like this in the details, but there's Michael Gratz's proposal includes lots of the kinds of elements that are very much in discussion around the country right now. How do you look at a proposal like that and its impact?
Mike's proposal is, I think, the most serious, comprehensive proposal out there right now. It's comprehensive because it does, in fact, move the system toward a consumption tax. It's serious because it's not some pie-in-the-sky proposal that says rewrite the entire tax code and stick it on a postcard or devise a plan, a tax like the national sales tax that has never been enacted anywhere at a high rate, anywhere in the history of the world. So Mike's plan, it's politically realistic. It's what you might call administratively realistic. It doesn't promise amazing things. You know, Mike isn't saying we're going to double the growth rate for the next 10 years and so on.
Right.
So it's a really nice contribution to the debate on tax reform that goes beyond just his proposal goes well beyond, you know, tinker with this feature, tinker with that feature.
Are you ready to sign on then?
There are issues. I'm not ready to sign on to any proposal right now, and I'm sort of been touring around with one of my own. But I think the main issue I would see here is what Michael raised as the chicken soup issue, which is that Congress and the president and politicians and the American public want to treat every issue with a tax credit or a tax subsidy. And this is not some lefty liberal thing. I remember Newt Gingrich proposing tax credits for uses of computers in schools, and that everyone just naturally turns to the tax code.
So are you afraid that if there's any
implement
what's the fear that you're expressing there? Or what's
well,
your concern?
The issue here is that this proposal would eliminate those programs for now, but if there's really a demand for them, they're going to come back. And if they don't come, they can't come back in the income tax under this proposal because there's no income tax for middle-class households. So
right.
They're likely to come back in terms of actual government spending programs. So then instead of filling out one income tax form to get the benefits, people are going to have to fill out a separate form for child care benefits, a separate form for education credits, a separate form for savers credits, and it may... The simplification potential here may be vanishing. For example, unless all the states, the 40-some states that have income taxes, unless they also go to this $100,000 exemption, a lot of those 150 million people are going to have to file state forms, and they're going to have to fill out all the information they would normally have to fill out on a federal form to do that. So This isn't in any way a damning critique of the proposal. I think it's a wonderful contribution, and it should be on the table. And given the type of things the president is likely to consider, I hope he considers this very seriously. But it's more a comment on the politics and the nature of tax policy trade-offs to note that you don't get rid of the issues by moving to this system. You just sort of reshuffle them, and they're going to come back.
Though we can hear the yearning for simplicity out there, and yet at the same time the fear of how does the burden get shifted once it gets into the political hurly-burly. We're talking about tax reform tonight. We're at 1-800-423-8255, and Edward is calling from New York City. Hi, Edward. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question really is on the transition and the savings that I already have. And basically, the savings that I have, I've already paid taxes on. And
so a transition, let's say, to a consumption tax, you mean, Edward?
Exactly.
Okay.
So the savings I've already paid a high amount of tax on.
Right.
And when I spend them again under this new system, I'm going to have to pay a high tax rate on them one more time.
So you're feeling double taxation coming down the pike.
Yes, and how would the transition be handled?
That's a great question. William Gale, I know you've written exactly about this, and I know there's no concrete answer to that, but I guess hypothetically, how might a transition be handled?
Well, there are lots of answers depending on the tax system. One of the virtues of Michael's system, by the way, is that there isn't a transition issue. But if you were to go, say, to a flat tax...
Now, may I just ask why there's not? Because he does introduce the consumption.
Because he's not getting rid of the existing corporate income tax and existing income tax. Let me explain where the transition issue comes from.
Okay.
Suppose that under the current income tax, a firm builds a $1 billion factory in year one and then starts taking depreciation deductions over time. And then in year two, we switch to a flat tax. Well, the flat tax doesn't allow depreciation for old investments. It just gives you a complete deduction for new investments. So if you didn't have transition relief, that firm would lose all of its future depreciation.
Right, right.
So they would feel like they had been ripped off. So they would lobby Congress to say, you have to give us our old transition, our old depreciation deductions. And they do the same thing on their interest deductions and so on. The basic point is if you change the rules of the game, you're going to catch some people in midstream, and they're going to want to continue to play under the old rules when that's to their advantage.
But William Gale, to take that, if you would, take that from the corporation to the citizen. Edward's calling not as a corporate giant, but as
right.
a citizen saying, I've saved this money. I paid taxes already on what I've got saved here. If we go to consumption tax, I feel like I get taxed twice. Is he correct?
Well, yes, he's exactly correct. If there's no transition relief. Let me add, though, that most of the growth effects, people talk about consumption taxes raising economic growth and stuff like that. Most of the growth effects come precisely from this double tax that this very astute caller is aware of. And the reason the growth effects come from that is that it's basically a tax on past behavior. So we've got all this saving in the country. We basically tax it a second time, and that lets us lower the tax rate on all future consumption. But the growth rate stems from this double taxation. The growth effect stems from this double taxation of the existing capital stock, or most of the growth effect.
Michael Gratz, to Edward's question, William Gale saying, "Well, yes, you will be taxed twice on that, and that's where the growth bump comes in this equation."
Well, not under my proposal. I mean, my proposal avoids the transition problem that Edward has asked about is a big question. That usually comes up only among the specialists, but a number of these plans, and including another plan by Senators Nunn and Domenici offered a few years ago for a consumption tax, have foundered on transition problems. But I don't have a transition problem because the middle-income people, or the people below $100,000, are not paying any income tax. They're paying consumption tax instead.
But if Edward's making $200,000,
but if Edward's paying $200,000, he's still paying his income tax. He's going to pay some tax on consumption, but he would be paying income tax on the money below $100,000.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only when you really get rid of the income tax and you don't allow people who have assets where they've got a cost that they're going to recover, so that the problem for an individual is that if the savings, you've bought an asset, you've bought stock, let us say,
okay,
and you've paid $100,000 for the stock. Well, under consumption tax, when you sell the stock, you pay tax on the full $100,000 you consume,
mm-hmm,
whereas under an income tax, you've already paid that tax, and you can consume the $100,000 tax-free.
But Edward is right to watch out for that savings wallet there, and that can take. Hey, let's get another call here. Judith is calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Judith. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Just fine. What's on your mind, Judith?
Well, actually, I probably heard the word reform used about 100 times.
Maybe 110. Maybe 110, Judith.
Yes. Anyway, the word reform has a specific meaning, which is to make better. It is a spin word. And so when President Bush is proposing, quote, tax reform, that already is an editorial opinion. And so I feel that that the media has really bought into the use of this language, and it should be using neutral words like change, or perhaps we're talking about tax changes in the tax code.
So that issue of framing is right there, you know, but it's so tempting because we want to think in terms of positive change. We like to think in terms of reform.
Or not, history will tell. I happen to be a skeptic, but nevertheless, I do think that we should, the media and spokespeople, except those who are making like proposals, should be using more neutral language.
We hear you loud and clear, and plenty of reason for skepticism there. William Gale, how about it? Are you willing to attach the label reform or to the debate that's going on now, the push that's going on now in the positive sense of the word?
I think it is an excellent comment that was just made. I think it's more likely that what we're going to get is tax deform rather than reform.
Ouch.
And here's why. The tax system is exactly that, a system. And what the president's talking about is doing things like exempting more saving, return from saving on from taxes. All right. Well, if you exempt basically interest income, which is one form of saving, but you don't stop interest deductions, all right, then you've created a mammoth shelter. So, for example, Michael and I, under that system, could each lend each other, quote unquote, $1 million, and could each, quote, pay each other interest, unquote, and we could each get a deduction for the interest payment and not have to report the income.
So watch out, not necessarily any guarantee of something like tax heaven coming here. William Gale, Michael Gretz, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about President Bush's call for tax reform. You may call it something else. You can join the conversation. If the country could conceive a better tax system, more fair, more efficient, could the country get there politically? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about President Bush's call for tax reform, for a big change in the tax system. Some people call it reform. Some tonight want to call it something else. You can join this conversation tonight. What do you see? What's the moving spirit that you hear in the Bush push for tax overhaul? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight, William Gale, joins us from San Francisco. He's Deputy Director and Senior Fellow of Economic Studies at the Brookings Institution. And Michael Gretz is with us, Professor of Law at Yale University, author of The Decline and Fall of the Income Tax. Lee is calling right now from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Lee. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. My point is that I'm looking for any kind of changes in the tax code to be fair. And by fair, I mean that people who have greater wealth will pay a greater portion of their wealth in taxes, although I do think it's important that everybody contribute towards running our government. And I also think another important principle is that the government needs to have enough money to run on. Being simple is good, but it's not as important to those other two points to me. What President Bush has been talking about, all the proposals that he calls reform, as the previous caller pointed out,
mm-hmm.
I don't see as being reformed, and I don't see them as meeting the criteria of fairness. They only meet the criteria of simple, and they're all aimed at putting more of the tax burden on wages and less of the tax burdens on wealth, and I think it should be pretty much the other way around.
Lee, we've got it, and let us pick up those observations. William Gale, first to you. Is the general drift here toward taxing labor more than wealth or capital?
Yes, absolutely. The taxation of capital income has been reduced significantly the last three or four years. Most of the proposals on the table that the White House is discussing have the feature that they would push that trend even farther.
And what's the rationale for that? Is it all around? Do they contend that they can have more growth that way, or they just want to move more wealth toward wealth?
Well, it's kind of like the war in Iraq. The rationale changes every week, and all of the rationale that are given can be shown to be flawed. But I think the ultimate rationale is politically that's what the president wants to do. The caller raised another really important issue, which is normally we separate discussions of the revenue level mm-hmm. from tax reform, but we don't really have that luxury anymore.
Because the deficits are so big.
Because deficits are so big and they're going to get worse. And so one of the things we need to think about in reforming the system is coming up with a reform that will allow us to raise revenues in the future. Now, raising revenues in the future does not mean we should not care about equity or the economic performance of the tax system. If the more we need to raise revenue, the more important it is that the tax system be structured as efficiently as possible. Saying that we need to raise revenue heightens the importance of equity and efficiency issues. It doesn't in any way deny their importance.
And Michael Gratz, what about the perspective from that 100 million plus households that you were talking about earlier? As you see the movement toward changing this big system, should people who are in that 100 million, not in the wealthiest part, but in 100 million, 150 million households, should they be supporting this move toward what's called tax reform in Washington? Does it look like a good thing for most Americans or not?
Well, it depends on what they want. I mean, I think that the point that Bill made earlier about the temptation in Congress to give people tax breaks for this or that kind of spending have been enormous, and those are tax breaks that are widespread. So some people may be enjoying those breaks, and they may not care for a tax change, and others are not enjoying them, and they would be happier. I would think everyone wants to get the IRS out of their lives and not have to file tax returns.
But people also care about fairness, and most people also care about a balanced budget at some point.
Well, this is fair, and this is a revenue system that actually can produce the revenues to pay for the spending that the country wants. I mean, the problem with the current system is that what everybody wants to do is give tax breaks. Democrats want to give tax breaks and raise tax rates, and Republicans want to give tax breaks and lower tax rates.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody wants to give these tax breaks for this or that, and I don't believe that we're going to find direct government spending replacing all these tax cuts. So I think that this is a system that's much more stable and much friendlier to the American people than the system we now have or the system we're likely to have if we stick with the current income tax as our source of revenue, as our only source of revenue.
William Gale, President Bush talks about whatever changes are made being revenue neutral. That is, from a Republican president, that's a kind of attempt to guarantee that he's not hiking taxes. He won't raise taxes overall. But we've got a deficit. So how does revenue neutrality work?
Well, it's even worse than that. It's really important to emphasize the budget this year. The president is going to go to the State of the Union, go up to Capitol Hill, and make his proposals. He will make a proposal to make the tax cuts permanent, and that will burn a very large multi-trillion-dollar hole in the federal budget over umpteen years. Now, he says he wants tax reform to be revenue neutral, but it's sort of like ordering a large pizza and then a Diet Coke. You know, once you make the tax cuts permanent, you've done enormous damage to the fiscal status of the country. And so at that point, if you're willing to be revenue neutral, it's good that he's not proposing to cut taxes more in tax reform, but we need to be thinking not of revenue neutrality, but of ways to raise revenues in the long term, or we're going to have huge cuts in government health benefits like Medicare.
And you're talking really huge. I've seen the numbers you've put out there. You're talking very substantial. Michael Gretz, you've just got half a minute left here. Well, give us your real politic assessment of what's likely to come out of these next couple of years, the cutting edge of this second term. Do you expect dramatic reform, significant reform, or not?
Well, I hope so. I mean, the pessimistic view is the one that Bill has been espousing, that we will have only tinkering and an inadequate revenue system. I think the president has an enormous opportunity to move the country ahead if he's willing to be bold and willing to be fair and willing to produce a system that will be adequate to the revenues that we need and that will not redistribute the tax burden down the income tax. Now, a lot of his colleagues in the Republican Party are not interested in that, and the question will be whether we'll have leadership from the president and whether we'll have equal leadership from the Congress.
Well, we'll have to hang on to our wallets and our critical faculties. Michael Gretz, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
And William Gale, thanks so much for your time tonight. Great to have you.
Thanks.
Listeners, good luck with those taxes. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, Hanukkah music from an unlikely source. This is On Point. Tonight is the last night of Hanukkah, the eight-day Jewish festival of lights. Despite Adam Sandler's contribution, the body of Hanukkah music pales in comparison with the panoply of Christmas tunes and carols sung each year. But among the musicians who have composed lyrics for Hanukkah is one big surprise, Woody Guthrie. Guthrie's daughter, Nora, recently discovered dozens of Jewish-themed lyrics that the Dust Bowl balladeer had penned but never set to music. She asked the Klezmatics, a New York City klezmer band, to compose melodies for the lyrics. The result is the Klezmatics' new CD, Woody Guthrie's Happy, Joyous Hanukkah. Tonight, the Klezmatics' lead vocalist, Lawrence Sklamberg, brings us some of Woody Guthrie's Hanukkah compositions and describes how the famed folk singer came to create songs about Hanukkah and Judaism.
How many nights for Hanukkah, happy, joyous Hanukkah, nights and days, days and nights, happy, joyous Hanukkah. Hey to the nights of Hanukkah, happy, joyous Hanukkah, hey to the days and hey to the nights, happy, joyous Hanukkah.
Woody Guthrie came to writing songs about Jewish holidays and about Jewish life in Brooklyn. Through being married to Marjorie Mazia, who was a dancer with the Martha Graham Company. Her mother was a well-known Yiddish poet and songwriter named Eliza Greenblatt, often characterized as a woman Jewish troubadour, Jewish woman troubadour, wrote lots of wonderful songs and poems, and was a staunch Zionist and advocate for human rights. In that respect, Woody identified with her as a writer and as a human rights person, and they kind of had this professional relationship critiquing each other's work. He was inspired to study Jewish history and write songs about Hanukkah, for instance.
Round and round my Hanukkah tree, round and round I go. Round and round my Hanukkah tree because I love you so. Round and round my Hanukkah tree, round and round we go. Round and round I'll hold your hand because you love me so. Round and round my Hanukkah tree, round and round we go. Round and round I'll hold your hand because you love me so.
He definitely is writing from the point of being somewhat of an outsider. So the songs are speaking from his own experience there. So, for instance, he has a song called Hanukkah Tree. Now, a lot of people would kind of ruffle their feathers a little bit because there's this whole kind of thing about how Hanukkah is not the Jewish Christmas, and it's really a separate thing, and it's really a lesser Jewish holiday, and so Jews don't have a Hanukkah tree. However, apparently the Guthrie family had some sort of a shrub, and it wasn't a Hanukkah bush, which is kind of the stereotypical thing that Jews supposedly have to be the equivalent of a Christmas tree. And they didn't have a Christmas tree, but they had a Hanukkah tree. So they're all kind of his own quirky take on Hanukkah.
It's Hanukkah, Hanukkah, round and around. Honey cake, Hanukkah, eat them down. Latkes and goody things all over town. It's Hanukkah, Hanukkah time. It's Hanukkah, Hanukkah, shaky my hand. My candles are burning all over this land to light the dark road for the man passing by. It's Hanukkah, Hanukkah time.
His personality really, really comes through in the lyrics. I mean, the way he says things are very specifically his. In addition to the fact that they're kind of a quirky take on Hanukkah, I think that you could tell that they were his words. No one else would write particular things, come up with turns of phrase like Hanukkah, Hanukkah. It's Hanukkah, Hanukkah, round and around. Honey cake, Hanukkah, eat them down. Latkes and goody things all over town. I mean, it's not the sort of thing that most people would, the way most people would sing about Hanukkah.
Hanukkah, Hanukkah time. My name is King Cyrus, my order I give. You Jews can go back to your home to build your holy temple again in the land of Palestine.
The Many and the Few, it's based on what I believe is an Irish folk tune. The song, it's an epic poem about the story of Hanukkah. And again, it's a very Woody Guthrie take on it. So it doesn't sound like these kind of hackneyed English Jewish things that you hear where people have songs about the Hanukkah story, about, you know, that sound, all sound kind of like the Ten Commandments, that kind of, you know, very grand kind of language. It's very eloquent, but at the same time, it's very plain spoken.
From that land called Babylon, I'll read you my Talmud, Torah book, and the prophet's dreams to you. And you'll be fertile and multiply if you keep your Torah true.
He has a particularly wonderful insight into the troubles of humans, and his songs are so, you know, uplifting, even if they're about some sort of a depressing subject or a serious subject. He just has a certain way of making you feel good and human.
As the king of Syria and Palestine, Antiochus the Fourth, you'll stand to kill the Jews if they refuse to worship our idols and gods.
Lawrence Klamberg is lead vocalist for the Klezmatics. The group's new CD is Woody Guthrie's Happy, Joyous Hanukkah. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Keeping the Sabbath laws by the soldiers, I see him slain. It's one by one, my seven sons in front of my eyes cut down.